European Consortium for the Certificate of Attainment in Modern Languages. English Language. Listening. Level C1. Part 1.
You're going to hear a story of a woman who, for a short while, became famous in the United States. While listening, choose the correct answer. There is an example at the beginning. You're going to hear the text twice. Do as much as you can the first time and finish your work the second time. Finally, you're going to have 60 seconds to complete your answers. Now you have 90 seconds to study the sentences below.
Now listen to the recording.
Over America's relatively brief history, 42 individuals have served as president, but the names of the hundreds who sought the office and lost are often forgotten. This week, we bring you contenders, portraits of some of the most groundbreaking and unusual presidential candidates from elections past. Today, Victoria Woodhull. In 1872, at a time when most women couldn't even vote, Woodhull became the first woman in American history to run for president. Our story was produced by Joe Richman and Samara Freemark of Radio Diaries.
My name is Amanda Friskin, and I wrote the book Victoria Woodhull's Sexual Revolution. Woodhull came from an unusual family, the Claflins. She grew up in a small town in Ohio, but they moved a lot, kind of traveling salesman, catch-as-catch-can. And at the age of 14, Woodhull was married off by her parents to a man who proved to be an alcoholic, and she had a pretty hard life with him. She was traveling around when she said she had a revelation to go out there and declare her right to be a woman in public and to be a powerful woman. And so she packed up and came to New York.
This was an era where a woman could not vote, could not enter a restaurant, a store, an establishment of any kind unless she was escorted by a man. It was controversial for women to do anything, but she had the foresight not to accept the way society was.
She started a radical newspaper. She opened the first women's stock brokerage firm. But the thing that gave her national fame was when she sent a card to the New York Herald declaring her candidacy for the presidency.
If the men should see the women going to the polls.
In the 19th century, lots of women were making claims about women's rights. You might think that women suffragists turned to Woodhull, and some of them did. But the suffragists in the 1870s tended to be middle-class to upper-middle-class women, more conventional, more serious. Woodhull was really an outsider, not well-educated, rather uncouth, and some of them just thought she was insane.
Though all the men should frown on us when going to the polls.
The thing that really made Woodhull notorious was when she gave a speech in New York City on November 20th, 1871, entitled The Principles of Social Freedom. In that speech, she claimed marriage was a form of tyranny for women.
It is high time that your sisters and daughters should no longer be led to the altar like sheep to the shambles.
1872, she was nominated by the Equal Rights Party at a convention in New York City.
It was very easy for the press to lampoon this. They thought it was ridiculous.
About 800 members of the Woodhull Wing assembled yesterday morning at Apollo Hall. The exercises were opened by the singing of Hail Columbia, after which a frivolous and tedious discussion on irrelevant topics arose.
The Equal Rights Party advocated women's rights to fair wages in the workplace, shorter work days, and they also advocated civil rights for freedmen and women. And when the discussion over the vice presidency came up, they nominated probably the most well-known African-American man at the time, Frederick Douglass. But they didn't ask him first, and he never accepted the nomination. He felt that it was probably wiser not to dignify the nomination with a response. The convention was really the high point for Woodhull, and after that, things really went downhill for her. As a result of the notoriety of the nomination, Woodhull was evicted from her home, and she had some trouble making ends meet.
She was arrested for sending obscenities through the mail under laws that no longer exist, the Comstock laws. And on election day, she sat in jail.
Woodhull wasn't on the ballot anywhere on the election of 1872. So in terms of actual voting numbers, we have no record that anyone voted for Woodhull. She was a woman who's kind of a huckster, has a terrible reputation, who may have at least temporarily done the cause more harm than good, but she's the first woman to put her name out there and say, I want to run for president. It makes for a very complicated founding narrative for women. You want someone really beyond reproach. You want the George Washington for women. And you don't get that with Woodhull. She was a flawed first, but she's still the first. I mean, she's the one we have to live with.
Now you have 30 seconds to check and complete your work.
Listen to the recording again.
Over America's relatively brief history, 42 individuals have served as president, but the names of the hundreds who sought the office and lost are often forgotten. This week, we bring you contenders, portraits of some of the most groundbreaking and unusual presidential candidates from elections past. Today, Victoria Woodhull. In 1872, at a time when most women couldn't even vote, Woodhull became the first woman in American history to run for president. Our story was produced by Joe Richman and Samara Freemark of Radio Diaries.
My name is Amanda Friskin, and I wrote the book Victoria Woodhull's Sexual Revolution. Woodhull came from an unusual family, the Claflins. She grew up in a small town in Ohio, but they moved a lot, kind of traveling salesman, catch as catch can. And at the age of 14, Woodhull was married off by her parents to a man who proved to be an alcoholic, and she had a pretty hard life with him. She was traveling around when she said she had a revelation to go out there and declare her right to be a woman in public and to be a powerful woman. And so she packed up and came to New York.
This was an era where a woman could not vote, could not enter a restaurant, a store, an establishment of any kind unless she was escorted by a man. It was controversial for women to do anything, but she had the foresight not to accept the way society was.
She started a radical newspaper. She opened the first women's stock brokerage firm. But the thing that gave her national fame was when she sent a card to the New York Herald declaring her candidacy for the presidency.
If the men should see the women going to the polls.
In the 19th century, lots of women were making claims about women's rights. You might think that women suffragists turned to Woodhull, and some of them did. But the suffragists in the 1870s tended to be middle class to upper middle class women, more conventional, more serious. Woodhull was really an outsider, not well educated, rather uncouth, and some of them just thought she was insane.
Though all the men should frown on us when going to the polls.
The thing that really made Woodhull notorious was when she gave a speech in New York City on November 20th, 1871, entitled The Principles of Social Freedom. In that speech, she claimed marriage was a form of tyranny for women.
It is high time that your sisters and daughters should no longer be led to the altar like sheep to the shambles.
1872, she was nominated by the Equal Rights Party at a convention in New York City.
It was very easy for the press to lampoon this. They thought it was ridiculous.
About 800 members of the Woodhull Wing assembled yesterday morning at Apollo Hall. The exercises were opened by the singing of Hail Columbia, after which a frivolous and tedious discussion on irrelevant topics arose.
The Equal Rights Party advocated women's rights to fair wages in the workplace, shorter work days, and they also advocated civil rights for freedmen and women. And when the discussion over the vice presidency came up, they nominated probably the most well-known African-American man at the time, Frederick Douglass. But they didn't ask him first, and he never accepted the nomination. He felt that it was probably wiser not to dignify the nomination with a response. The convention was really the high point for Woodhull, and after that, things really went downhill for her. As a result of the notoriety of the nomination, Woodhull was evicted from her home, and she had some trouble making ends meet.
She was arrested for sending obscenities through the mail under laws that no longer exist, the Comstock laws. And on election day, she sat in jail.
Woodhull wasn't on the ballot anywhere on the election of 1872. So in terms of actual voting numbers, we have no record that anyone voted for Woodhull. She was a woman who's kind of a huckster, has a terrible reputation, who may have at least temporarily done the cause more harm than good, but she's the first woman to put her name out there and say, I want to run for president. It makes for a very complicated founding narrative for women. You want someone really beyond reproach. You want the George Washington for women. And you don't get that with Woodhull. She was a flawed first, but she's still the first. I mean, she's the one we have to live with.
Now you have 1 minute to check and complete your work. This is the end of part one.
Part two.
You're going to hear parts of an audio guide that introduces two of the best colleges in Cambridge. While listening, complete the sentences with a few words. There is an example at the beginning. You're going to hear the text twice. Do as much as you can the first time and finish your work the second time. Finally, you're going to have 90 seconds to complete your answers. Now you have 90 seconds to study the sentences below.
Now listen to the recording.
Hello, and welcome to Cambridge. Cambridge is not only one of the oldest and most respected universities in the world, it's also a unique place. And it continues to generate a strong sense of attachment in many of the people who come to visit, as well as study, live and work here. St John's College on St John's Street. John's is the largest Cambridge college. Its spectacular range of buildings covers almost every historical era and reflects the expansion of the university over the last eight centuries. Perhaps the most famous bridge in Cambridge. The Bridge of Sighs is the perfect spot to appreciate the beauty of the college gardens and backs. The Tudor Gatehouse is dominated by the elaborate coat of arms of Lady Margaret Beaufort, who founded St John's in 1511 on the site of an old Augustinian hospital. She was helped in this task by Bishop John Fisher, who was something of a catalyst in the 16th century university. Largely due to Fisher's influence, the newly founded College of St John's, along with Queen's College, of which he was president, became significant centres of the so-called New Learning in Cambridge. This was characterised by an emphasis on mathematics and the study of classical and biblical texts. The first court you enter, known simply as First Court, was completed by 1516 and originally housed a small nucleus of fellows and scholars. Second Court was built in the 1600s in the first major expansion of the college. Today, both courts, fine examples of Tudor red brick, remain hardly altered. First Court is dominated by the High Victorian Gothic Revival Chapel, designed by Sir George Gilbert Scott and completed in 1869. An elaborate exterior is matched by a rich interior, with stained glass, a painted ceiling and numerous memorials. One recent addition commemorates alumni William Wilberforce and Thomas Clarkson, who devoted their lives to the abolition of slavery. In the 1820s and 30s, St John's expanded over the river via the atmospheric Bridge of Sighs into New Court. This was the first major building by any college west of the river. Its distinctive neo-Gothic silhouette is topped by an octagonal centrepiece known as the wedding cake. The post-war years saw further expansion and a need for yet more undergraduate accommodation at St John's. Many landmark buildings followed, including the Cripps Building, completed in 1967, a sinuous modern construction of concrete and Portland stone. The most recent addition, the New College Library by Edward Cullen and Architects, was opened in 1994. But St. John's also owns the oldest domestic building in Cambridge, the School of Pythagoras, which may have been built around 1200. It thus predates the college itself, but is still amazingly in regular use. Trinity College on Trinity Street. Trinity was founded and richly endowed by Henry VIII in 1546. There's a statue of this powerful Tudor monarch above the great gate here. Spot the rather less than regal sceptre in Henry's right hand. Yes, it's an old wooden chair leg, a student prank which has become a permanent feature. Trinity's status as Cambridge's largest and wealthiest college is reflected in the sheer dimensions of Great Court, which, if you decide to visit, is entered through the gatehouse. The layout of this court is the work of Thomas Neville, master of the college, who reorganised the site completely from 1593. The range of buildings include a Jacobean dining hall, 16th-century chapel and 15th-century clock tower. Neville's court, next to the river, is equally spectacular. Originally a three-sided cloistered court, it was completed, in 1695, by the addition of a neoclassical library designed by Sir Christopher Wren. The library's new, unfamiliar style of architecture caused quite a stir in Cambridge when it was first built, and it's certainly no less impressive today. Before the Fitzwilliam Museum was opened in the mid-19th century, the Wren Library was the nearest thing in Cambridge to a museum, an imposing building full of sculpture and paintings, as well as furniture designed by Wren himself. By the 17th century, Trinity had established itself as a great centre of learning, with a reputation particularly in science which has never diminished. Its distinguished alumni include over 30 Nobel Prize-winning scientists, two kings and six prime ministers, as well as numerous poets and writers. Some of these are commemorated in a series of striking statues in the Wren Library and the Antechapel. Isaac Newton, who arrived in 1661 as a sizar, a poor undergraduate who paid his way by doing menial tasks, completed his best-known mathematical and scientific works here. Outside the great gate on the right, in front of his former study, is an apple tree, said to be descended from the one at Newton's own home in Lincolnshire, that inspired his understanding of gravity.
Now you have 30 seconds to check and complete your work. Listen to the recording again.
Hello, and welcome to Cambridge. Cambridge is not only one of the oldest and most respected universities in the world, it's also a unique place. And it continues to generate a strong sense of attachment in many of the people who come to visit, as well as study, live, and work here. St. John's College on St. John's Street. John's is the largest Cambridge college. Its spectacular range of buildings covers almost every historical era and reflects the expansion of the university over the last eight centuries. Perhaps the most famous bridge in Cambridge, the Bridge of Sighs, is the perfect spot to appreciate the beauty of the college gardens and backs. The Tudor Gatehouse is dominated by the elaborate coat of arms of Lady Margaret Beaufort, who founded St. John's in 1511 on the site of an old Augustinian hospital. She was helped in this task by Bishop John Fisher, who was something of a catalyst in the 16th century university. Largely due to Fisher's influence, the newly founded College of St. John's, along with Queen's College, of which he was president, became significant centres of the so-called New Learning in Cambridge. This was characterised by an emphasis on mathematics and the study of classical and biblical texts. The first court you enter, known simply as First Court, was completed by 1516 and originally housed a small nucleus of fellows and scholars. Second Court was built in the 1600s in the first major expansion of the college. Today, both courts, fine examples of Tudor red brick, remain hardly altered. First Court is dominated by the High Victorian Gothic Revival Chapel, designed by Sir George Gilbert Scott and completed in 1869. An elaborate exterior is matched by a rich interior, with stained glass, a painted ceiling, and numerous memorials. One recent addition commemorates alumni William Wilberforce and Thomas Clarkson, who devoted their lives to the abolition of slavery. In the 1820s and 30s, St. John's expanded over the river via the Atmospheric Bridge of Sighs into New Court. This was the first major building by any college west of the river. Its distinctive neo-Gothic silhouette is topped by an octagonal centrepiece known as the Wedding Cake. The post-war years saw further expansion and a need for yet more undergraduate accommodation at St. John's. Many landmark buildings followed, including the Cripps Building, completed in 1967, a sinuous modern construction of concrete and Portland stone. The most recent addition, the New College Library by Edward Cullen and Architects, was opened in 1994. But St. John's also owns the oldest domestic building in Cambridge, the School of Pythagoras, which may have been built around 1200. It thus predates the college itself, but is still amazingly in regular use. Trinity College on Trinity Street. Trinity was founded and richly endowed by Henry VIII in 1546. There's a statue of this powerful Tudor monarch above the great gate here. Spot the rather less than regal sceptre in Henry's right hand. Yes, it's an old wooden chair leg, a student prank which has become a permanent feature. Trinity's status as Cambridge's largest and wealthiest college is reflected in the sheer dimensions of Great Court, which, if you decide to visit, is entered through the gatehouse. The layout of this court is the work of Thomas Neville, master of the college, who reorganised the site completely from 1593. The range of buildings include a Jacobean dining hall, 16th-century chapel, and 15th-century clock tower. Neville's court, next to the river, is equally spectacular. Originally a three-sided cloistered court, it was completed, in 1695, by the addition of a neoclassical library designed by Sir Christopher Wren. The library's new, unfamiliar style of architecture caused quite a stir in Cambridge when it was first built, and it's certainly no less impressive today. Before the Fitzwilliam Museum was opened in the mid-19th century, the Wren Library was the nearest thing in Cambridge to a museum, an imposing building full of sculpture and paintings, as well as furniture designed by Wren himself. By the 17th century, Trinity had established itself as a great centre of learning, with a reputation particularly in science which has never diminished. Its distinguished alumni include over 30 Nobel Prize-winning scientists, two kings and six prime ministers, as well as numerous poets and writers. Some of these are commemorated in a series of striking statues in the Wren Library and the Antechapel. Isaac Newton, who arrived in 1661 as a sizar, a poor undergraduate who paid his way by doing menial tasks, completed his best-known mathematical and scientific works here. Outside the great gate on the right, in front of his former study, is an apple tree, said to be descended from the one at Newton's own home in Lincolnshire, that inspired his understanding of gravity.
Now you have 90 seconds to check and complete your work.
This is the end of the second part.